The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
MC. On my calendar, it says that today is Columbus Day. And what I remember when I was a child, we didn't go to school on Columbus Day, but my children went to school today. Then though some of their friends who are in different school districts didn't go to school today. And I think that it represents a change in our society about this particular day and about how we see Columbus. And some people are celebrating Indigenous People Day. And I think that a number of cities now around the country have passed resolutions that this should be Indigenous People Day. But that upset some of the Italian Americans, because it turns out this is also Italian American Day, maybe because Columbus is Italian, was Italian. And so this points to, I think, a lot of things in our society, our social life, how much strife there can be, in so many different ways, but also across different divides. We live in a society of all kinds of social divides. And one of the big tasks, I think, for the globe is how to live in some of these divides that we live amongst, or that we find amongst ourselves, and so much prejudice, so much bias, so much animosity, so much stereotyping that goes on. And one of the early teachings, I think, of Joseph Goldstein, or someone in our particular Insight school, had to do with, in the 60s or 70s, maybe as hippies or something, going off to India to learn meditation. And so they took the bus across the Middle East and across probably Iran, Afghanistan, and up to Pakistan, down to India. And back in the time when it was relatively safer to do that, though John Travis, one of my colleagues, spent time in jail in the 60s in Turkey on his route to India. But they came across this huge desert. And they were just taking this bus across this huge desert. And there was, apparently, the way the story is told, there was no real markers of anything, it was just desert. And in the middle of the desert was a border post and a little fence on either side of the border post. And the bus had to stop. But they looked around and, like, it's just desert, you know. This is a human construct. It's not like any kind of special kind of divide. A real divide in the natural world is just like this flat land, and they've decided to draw a line through it. And now we have to stop the bus and get out. And so the very interesting issue in or teachings in Buddhism is to point to how much of our life is a social construct, and how much of our social lives and the divisions that we exist in are social constructs that we created, are conventional designations of some of the Buddhist terminology. And to be able to really see that and see what is a social construct, what's a construction of language, and has no inherent existent nature, I think is one of the contributions of something like meditation, where the mind gets quiet enough to see the workings of the mind and see how the mind produces thoughts and concepts and ideas and overlays them on top of our reality. It was one of my first realizations when I went to a Zen monastery and practiced there. I would walk around kind of amazed, looking at all the things I could see, kind of, and I could kind of feel or see or experience my mind, the expression I had for myself was painting my reality with reality. You know, like I would see the tree and, I mean, you see a tree, right? It's a tree. But I could feel how my mind was kind of labeling and making and seeing and projecting tree-ness on the tree. And maybe a tree is not a good example because a tree is supposedly a tree. But there are lots of things that The example I've used here before is, so this bell that we have here, you know, it's about a 6-inch or so diameter bell. And I once was in San Francisco, and I saw someone begging on the street with a brass Japanese bell just like this. And I almost, later I thought, I should have gone back and bought it. It looked like a really nice one. But, it's a bell here at IMC. It was a begging bowl for him. My teacher in Burma, he had something very similar to this that was a spittoon. And I don't know how you guys would feel if I was, you know, gargling up my saliva and going with perfect aim, you know, into my spittoon in the middle of a Dharma talk. You know, that probably some of you would think, what? A Buddhist teacher? So a spittoon. So, you know, so you can feel sometimes in the mind what it's like to kind of overlay a thing like this with a bell or begging bowl or spittoon or whatever. Whereas in the ordinary consciousness, I think we just take it for granted. It's a bell, you know, it's like, boom, that's what it is. So I think meditation helps a lot, slows the mind down or creates greater clarity in the mind so we can see the constructs arising in the mind so we see what goes on. And so that's nice for bells, but it's really important for people that we have all these divisions in our society which are, you know, some of them are social constructs, some of them have some reality to them, but to live by wrong social constructs has created a tremendous amount of suffering and pain in our world. And that was true in the time of the Buddha's life, and it was true now in our life. So I wanted to relate to you an ancient sutta, discourse of the Buddha, that addresses this issue in particular. And you could interpret it or apply it in many different ways in our modern society and the kind of divisions, social divisions that exist in our society and how they play out. So there were two Brahmins, students. They were priests in the Brahmanical religion of ancient India. And this text describes them as being really well educated. They were masters in the Vedic lore and very knowledgeable. So, and apparently fairly high status in their training to be priests. And they had an argument. And their argument was, one of them said that a person becomes a Brahmin, a high caste person. India back then, and to some degree still to this, it's a very caste-oriented society. And caste means it's a big division in countries like that. And it's very painful for some people who live in those caste divisions to live at the bottom of it and not to feel like they can move through or have move up through it. And so the Brahmins, kind of priestly caste, sometimes took themselves to be the top of the hierarchy. And they also believed, they had this lore, that they were born from, at least in how it's presented in the Buddhist texts, that they were born from the Brahma's mouth. And that's pretty good to be born there. You know, it's a high status up here. But the lowest class of caste was born from Brahma's foot. And foot in India is like, you know, kind of like the, considered pretty, you know, almost like, you know, the head is almost like pure and the foot's almost like defiled or something, impure or something. So it's pretty bad to be born from the foot of Brahma. And the Brahmins believed that there was a hereditary caste, so they were born into the caste by virtue of their birth. So one of these two Brahmin students, and his contribution to the argument was saying, a person is a Brahmin by being born that way, by being born to a lineage of Brahmins down through the generations. And the other Brahmin said, no. A person is a Brahmin by their actions, by their deeds, what they do. That's what makes a person a Brahmin. So they can't agree, and so they go to the Buddha. And the Buddha hears their argument, and then he offers his reply. And most people, you know, will assume that he agrees with the one who says that you're a Brahmin by virtue of your actions, not by your birth. But this is what he says. I will teach you the generic divisions of living beings. For there are many different species. Know first that the grass and trees, that their mark, their distinguishing characteristic, arises from their birth. Let me see, I had it. The distinguishing mark arises with their species. The word species is also the word jati, which means birth. And this idea is that by your birth, you're characterized who you are. And sometimes in India, in these ancient texts, your jati, your birth, is the same thing as saying your caste, how you're born. So you're just kind of going back and forth. It's a little hard to translate this in English. The distinguishing mark arises with one's birth. It arises with their species. So trees and grass, so certain, you know, there, you can distinguish different species of trees and plants by their distinguishing characteristics, and they're different species, different classes of things. And next comes the moths and the butterflies and the ants and the termites. Their distinguishing mark arises with their birth, you know, characterizes their species. And then he talks about the water-dwelling fish and the birds. He goes, so there are all these different things. He said, there's different species. You can actually distinguish, make clear distinctions between them. While in these births, the differences of birth make their distinctive mark, with humans, no differences of birth make a distinctive mark in them. Isn't that nice? That's what he wants to say. So there's only one species. Homo sapiens sapien. I always thought that sapien meant human knowers, but recently I found out that means wisdom, wise. So the wise homos, the wise, you know, hominids. And then we're the Homo sapiens sapiens. We have a lot to live up to. I hope we do soon. With humans, no differences of birth make a distinctive mark in them. Not in the hairs, not in the head, not in the ears, not in the eyes, not in the mouth, nor in the nose, nor in the lips, nor in the brows, nor in the shoulders or the neck, in the belly or the back, in the buttocks or the breasts, not in the hands, nor in the feet, nor in the fingers or the nails, nor in the knees, nor their thighs, nor in their color, nor in their color. That's a big one for many societies, distinguishing people by their color, or in their voice. Here, birth makes no distinctive mark as with other kinds of birth. So there's a wonderful list of human characteristics. Of course, we differ a little bit around those things, right? And there's a lot of human suffering around these differences. Well, you know, my height, my hair, my nose, my size, you know, all these, you know, my color, you know, this, all kinds of things, right? And people suffer a lot because of the social conventions and comparative thinking and around all these kinds of things. But the Buddha says, here birth makes no distinctive mark as with other kinds of species. In human bodies in themselves, nothing distinctive can be found. Distinction among human beings is purely verbal designation. So in terms of a real distinction, like separating out different species of humans, those distinctions are merely human, merely verbal designation. But then the Buddha is willing to make some distinctions. Now that he's said a claim that there are verbal designations, there are verbal designations that distinctions between people that he is willing to make. The people who make their living farming are farmers. The people who make their living through crafts are craftspeople. The people who make their living through merchandise are merchants. Those who make a living serving others are servants. Those who make a living stealing are robbers. Those who make a living by archery are archers. Those who make a living through priestly craft are chaplains. Those who govern the town and the realm are rulers. So here, the distinction the Buddha wants to make is not anything inherent by birth, but rather is by what they do. So here he's agreeing with the second Brahmin. It's by the actions that we distinguish people. And so what we do becomes important. You know, this is very simple things. It's kind of obvious, right? While you're farming, you're a farmer. While you're parenting, you're a parent. And the question is, when you're not actively parenting, are you still a parent? When do you pick up that role? When do you put it down? When do you pick up that identity? When do you put down that identity? And is an interesting question, since, you know, they're verbal designation based on what we do, they say. So, but then the Buddha goes on to define who is a Brahmin. And remember, Brahmin is seen as a high class person in society. And so it's kind of like maybe like saying, who is really an aristocrat? Or who's really the elite or something? And so now he's going to provide that explanation. I do not call a person a Brahmin by the person's origin or lineage. If attachments still lurk in that person, I call him, basically he says, someone who's pompous. But one who is unattached and clings no more, that is the one I call a Brahmin. So now he's beginning to redefine a Brahmin away from birth, being born in a particular caste, but making it available to anybody of any caste, of any situation, based on how they live, based on how they are and how they've been practiced and how they purified themselves. And this person he's willing to elevate to, you know, aristocratic level or an elite level or, you know, someone to be honored or respected. The person who endures without a trace of hate, abuse, violence, and bondage, with strength of patience, is the one I call a Brahmin. The one who does not flare up with anger is the one I call a Brahmin. The one who has laid aside weapons against all beings, frail and strong, who does not kill or have them killed, is the one I call a Brahmin. The one who is unopposed among opponents. It's a nice idea, unopposed among your opponents. The Buddha often said, you know, I have no argument with anyone. People argue with me, but I have no argument with them. Some man once came to the Buddha really angry with him about his teachings and the impact he was having in society. And he said, "What's your teaching?" And the Buddha said, "My teaching is such that I have no arguments with anyone." It made the man even more angry. the one who is unopposed among opponents, peaceful among those given to violence, I call a Brahmin. The one who has dropped all lust and hate, dropped conceit and contempt, is the one I call a Brahmin. Who in the world will never take what is not given, is the one I call a Brahmin. The one who has crossed to the further shore and meditates, is unperturbed and unperplexed, attained nibbana through non-clinging, is the one I call a Brahmin. So here he's redefining a Brahmin eventually to someone who's attained what, for the Buddhism, is the kind of purpose of the spiritual life. So has high spiritual status, or high spiritual attainment, of purifying themselves, freeing themselves of all these kinds of lust and hate and greed and clinging and these things. And then he goes on, for name and clan are assigned as mere designations in the world, originating in conventions. They are assigned here and there. For those who do not know this fact, wrong views are long underlain their hearts. Not knowing, they declare, one is only a Brahmin by birth. One is not a Brahmin by birth, nor by birth a non-Brahmin. By actions one is a Brahmin, by actions one is a non-Brahmin. So it's really what you do. So here he's measuring people by their actions and behavior. That's what, and the Buddha said, you're the heir and the owner of your actions. There's a tremendous emphasis in Buddhism focused on what you do. But actions are of three kinds. There's the physical actions, the verbal actions, and the mental actions. And the list of these kinds of qualities of a Brahmin are not just physical actions, but also the mental actions, not to have any hate, not to have any lust, not to have any conceit or contempt. So there's a very high standard of how much it's possible to, in the ancient language, to purify the heart and the mind, or to clarify the inner life, to set it free from what constricts it and narrows it and brings out the worst in human beings. In the Buddhist world of India and Sri Lanka, this particular verse is very, very, is resonated and is quoted and repeated a lot. It's very important in a way maybe we can't quite understand. Maybe there's probably categories in our society in America maybe they are comparable to this, that we could substitute Brahman here. I don't think I'll choose to try. It might offend someone. But I can, you can imagine some too. And here's a nice quote. So you probably heard the expression, love makes the world go round. So here's the Buddha. Action makes the world go round. Action makes this generation turn. Living beings are bound by action, like the chariot wheel by the linchpin. The action makes the world go round. So not only does the Buddha measure or designate people or distinguish people by their action, but he also says that action is really what has big consequences in the world. It makes the world turn around. And so we need to be careful with our action. We need to be careful with all our actions, including our mental action. And I think this is one of the very important contributions meditation can make, that it makes us, can heighten the clarity and the energy and the sharpness of the mind, so we can really track what's going on in our mind, the actions of our mind, including the ways in which we see each other and relate to each other, the divisions that we live by in our society because of fear or because of ignorance or because of just going along with tradition and convention about how we see society and the world. And I think it's very important, and I think as much as racism still exists in our country and prejudice exists in our country and all kinds of very painful divides exist in our country. I mean, there's people dying, right, because of these issues to this day in this country. It's an active, very big concern for society as a whole. My impression is that, I'm not an expert in this area, but there's enough momentum in American society, enough interest in American society, to try to overcome some of this divide. That I think America has a chance to be a model for other countries where it's much worse. There are countries in the world where it's, as we know, right, just right now, and we're in Syria and Iraq and Yemen, these places where people are doing terrible things to each other. And there the divide is religious. Some of it's religious, some of it's ethnic, all these divides. Some of these countries are the places where my friends took the bus trips across the desert, and there was just this border in the middle of nowhere, right? There's all these divides that in the desert of human society we create and put people outside. So I think it's a great thing, whatever effort we can do in this society, in our America, to become more attuned and more sensitive to cultural differences and distinguishings, to be more attuned and sensitive to where we fit in the whole world of prejudice and distinctions and divides that exist in our society, the ones that we don't even see yet or we don't even feel like we belong in, to really kind of become heightened and aware to this, I think is a great contribution to the whole world. And we'll make it so that we can all kind of live together more and more in harmony and respect for each other. It'd be great to treat all of. It'd be great if we could treat all of each other as Brahmins, you know, as nobility or something, the nobility or dignity of each person. One of the examples often held up of how the Buddha wanted society to be was how he created the monastic orders. And he said that the monastic orders are like the ocean. All the four great rivers flow into the ocean and they lose their names. So I think what he meant was that all the four great oceans are sometimes like all the four great or big castes in ancient India. There were four main caste systems. When all the people of the different castes joined into the Buddhist order, their caste background had no meaning anymore. And they all became the same. Some of the people who were the lowest in society had some of the lowest caste became some of the highest people in teachers and stuff in the monastic order. So what does it take? I would like to suggest that if you sit quietly, sharpen your mind in meditation and mindfulness, and watch very carefully the genesis, the birth of ideas you have about other people. Watch them arise. Get more and more sensitive to what gets born in your mind. And start questioning. Put a question mark around the interpretations, the assumptions, the projections, the commentary that you have about the people you run into. Notice how quick you do it. And put questions mark around it. Is this really true? And in that kind of question mark and pause of seeing what your mind does before... And slow down enough so you see the mind does it, as opposed to assume that how you see is what actually is there. Because how we see is through the filter of our thoughts. Put a question mark around it. And then practice something that is now seen as one of the really important strategies in diversity work and cultural competency and all this. And that is humility. A little bit of humility goes a long way. Humility meaning maybe you don't know. Maybe you don't know the person that you're with. Maybe you don't know the person that you've encountered. Maybe you don't know their background. Maybe you don't know what's happening to them. There's a lot you don't know. And so that kind of humility of not knowing allows you to kind of put aside for a while the interpretations, the judgments, the assumptions that you might have. And in that not knowing, you know, who would you ask or look more carefully and see? I'm very fond, as some of you know, that the word respect comes from a Latin meaning to inspect again, to look again, if, you know, like the spectacle. So to look again. And I think that if we can stop and look and give people a second chance, a third chance, and try to see below the surface what's going on. I learned this in a very powerful way. After I left the Zen monastery, I been there for about three years. So you know, and then I went up to a soon after leaving or something. I did a weekend workshop with Stephen Levine. Stephen Levine was one of the pioneers in the 70s and 80s of doing hospice work, working with people who are dying, and he put on some really great workshops and retreats on death and dying. And so I signed up for this. I read his book, Who Dies, and I was very moved by the book, and I signed up for this workshop. And before the workshop started, we were all kind of milling outside in the courtyard before the conference area. And the people I saw there, they were just like ordinary people. Whatever that is. But, you know, they were kind of like ordinary, run-of-the-mill people, and, you know, and I, like, you know, that was my kind of assumption about them. And I kind of, oh, you know, this is... And then we went into the workshop, and Stephen Levine is he was brilliant in connecting with people and helping people open up. And he had, within a few minutes, seemed to me, as I remember, in the course of the weekend, he had people standing up and telling why they were there. And there were people who were dying. They had, you know, stage 4 cancer. There were people who had just lost their young child, had just died. And there was one death, one connection to death after another. And, you know, I just came, I was in Zen monastery, I'd been meditating, I'd been happy, you know, and my life was pretty good. And these were ordinary people. I thought, you know, their life was good. And I saw, wow, I did not know what was under the surface of these people. I didn't know what their background and experience was. And it was very humbling for me. And so now when I walk down the street and I see the ordinary people, or the non-ordinary people, you know, see people, I don't know who they are. I don't know what goes on behind them. I don't know their history and their life experience and what, you know, and what it means for them to be even alive, what it means for them to see me, what it means for them to see to be anything. So I want to be very careful with my assumptions. I want to be very careful with what I... I'll give you another example, a little one. So I was working as a chef, cook in a restaurant in San Francisco. And I was having a good time one day cooking, doing my work. And then there was a change of shifts. And I was up in the changing room and I was getting out of my chef uniform into my clothes. And a friend of mine came in to start his shift. And as soon as he came in, I was happy to see him. I was kind of happy-go-lucky. And I kind of greeted him with kind of a exuberance and kind of a joke and a little bit of teasing or something like that. It was all good meaning. He was my friend. That was kind of my affection for him. And what I, but I didn't take any time, the respect thing, to look again, to find out, who is this person? You know, maybe I don't know this person. Even if he was my friend, maybe I don't know him. You know, it's really good to wait. Take a time, get to know him. So someone very close to him had just died, and he was grieving. And so my way of joking and teasing with him was actually kind of painful. So I had this assumption, right? I kind of came with the old history ideas. So this also was very humbling for me. So this idea of take your time and learn to watch what your mind does. Learn what your emotions do when you encounter someone and put a question mark behind them. If someone's scary, put a question mark behind that and look again. Is this person really scary? If this person is different than you, put a question mark. Maybe they're not so different. If this person's the same as you, that's your mind does, put a question mark around that. Maybe they're not so same as you. And I think it's very respectful, very meaningful to live in a world where we have the mindfulness and the capacity to notice what our mind does and not believe everything is there. Put a question mark behind things and long enough to look again, long enough to give people a second chance to kind of show themselves, to reveal themselves. Who are these people? And because we live in a world where mutual respect and positive regard is really, you know, there's not enough of it. And whether it's in places of work or in our neighborhoods or on the streets or in the freeways, it's really good to want to do that. And then I'll end with, so this was a big issue apparently in the time of the Buddha, because there's a lot of suttas, a lot of discourse in the Buddha, a lot of teachings where the Buddha was addressing this issue of the divides, the caste divides in the society. So he had a number of arguments to talk about, you know, the different way of looking at caste or kind of create more sense of equality that we're, or look at the oneness of human beings. We're all one species, for example. And he said that, so someone also came along and wanted to know about the status of these Brahmins and maybe only they are special. And the Buddha responded, is it only Brahmins that can have loving kindness? What do you think? Only Brahmins that can be kind and loving and have goodwill? And so the answer, of course, the people in the text said, no, not only Brahmins can be kind and friendly and have goodwill. Other people can too. In fact, everyone can do. In fact, some Brahmins don't have much of it. And some others don't have much of it. But anybody can have it. And so for that Buddha, that pointed to the oneness, that we're all in it together. We have equal status. We have equal possibility. And so let's have lots of goodwill. And maybe that's how we all become Brahmins, is through our goodwill. So cultural humility, human humility, questioning your mind. I hope that your mindfulness practice, your meditation practice, sharpens your mind enough, clarifies your mind enough, you can watch how your marvelous mind works, so you don't believe it all. Thank you.